It is 8:09 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert with Antonia Juhas. We're joined now in KPFA studios by Shakti Butler. She is president and founder of World Trust Educational Services. She's the director of many films about race, gender, and privilege in America, and now working in a new medium, virtual reality. This Saturday at the Oakland Museum, she is putting on an event called Beyond Imagining, a Virtual Experience of Justice and Healing. She joins us now in KPFA studios to discuss it. Shakti Butler, thank you so much for coming in again.
My pleasure.
Can we start with basic concepts? What is healing justice? What is it that you're engaging with this project?
Well, Healing Justice is the title of my latest film, which is looking at justice through three different lenses. The first is intergenerational trauma. The second is an inquiry into, well, what is justice really? How do we define justice in this country? And the third is the role of healing trauma. And so that's the general idea.
This comes in the context of a lot of work that's starting to get traction around pursuing restorative justice mm-hmm. for people who've been convicted of crimes rather than punitive justice.
Right.
And I'm curious, like, what you think the limits are. We just went through this really public recall of a judge in the South Bay who was recalled for handing out a life sentence to a convicted sexual assailant from a very privileged background. And the public, and I think it was largely the progressive public, was outraged and thought it was important that this person and people like him be punished harshly and that signal be sent publicly. How do you bring a healing justice frame into a case like Brock Turner's?
Well, first of all, I think it's not that you either give out a light sentence or a tough sentence. I mean, the fact is that we live in a nation where punitive responses to crime are deeply embedded in our history. People are familiar with things like spare the rod and spoil the child, but they're not so understanding of forced sterilizations that have happened as a form of punishment for mental illness. But it's not one or the other. I think we need to relook at, well, what does justice actually mean? And what is appropriate in terms of making things whole? How do we address what's broken? And typically, it's not just punishment. In fact, punishment rarely is something that's deeply satisfying to anybody in the long run.
Mm. So what does an alternative look like?
Alternatives are everything from restorative justice to programs that keep people out of the justice system. My focus happens to be mostly on youth and what it is that gets them into the justice system in the first place, not so much the example that you gave, although someone else could talk about that much more deeply than I. But we're finding that because of racism and historical trauma, that young people are ending up in the justice system from very early ages on, and that the recidivism rate for that entry into the justice system is very high and eventually leads to adult prison. And so the question basically is, can we think of what else might be effective in terms of dealing with young people's lives in a way that makes them the viable members of their community that they should be?
So interrupt the school-to-prison pipeline.
Correct.
Before it ever gets to prison.
Yes, I like to call it the crib-to-prison pipeline.
Mm-hmm. What's the earliest place you can make an intervention?
The minute that you realize that someone is being harmed, no matter what role you play in society, so that could be someone from a professional perspective who sees a child who's being beaten or traumatized in some way, to what George Grew talks about when she talks about what does it mean for us to create the village? What does it mean for us to actually intervene and affect change through members of the community as well? So it's a much broader base of how do we take care of young people and how do we take care of each other?
We're speaking to Shakti Butler. She's president and founder of World Trust Educational Services, about to mount her first foray into virtual reality. That is an event called Beyond Imagining, a Virtual Experience of Justice and Healing, taking place at the Oakland Museum of California this Saturday, starting at 2 p.m. As luck would have it, we have two pairs of tickets to give away to that event. We're going to give them away early because we're going to be filling our phone lines up with callers later in the hour. We will give one pair of tickets each to callers 6 and 12. And again, that's for Shakti Butler's virtual reality event this Saturday at the Oakland Museum.
That's Brian's slight correction. The doors open at 2:30.
Oh, 2:30. Thank you for the correction. So the phone number is 510-848-4425. 510-848-4425. Tell us a little bit about working in the medium of virtual reality.
Oh my God. It's it's something that definitely, I think, appeals to younger people, but perhaps I could just tell you a little story that would make sense. When I was working on the film, Healing Justice, as is my way, I typically will show pieces of the film when I have the opportunity to varied audiences so I can get their response. And one woman in her comment about the clips that she saw was, I really could get into this restorative justice thing, but if somebody rapes my daughter, all bets are off.
Right.
And I totally not only understood what she was saying, but I have remembered what she said, like, almost daily. And what that represents to me is this boundary that we all have between what we call good and bad and right and wrong. It's not a fixed boundary. It's a boundary that depends upon what it is you're talking about. So in terms of justice, it's really looking at what does it mean for me to get a pound of flesh, basically. That's an expression some people don't like, so let me say that up front. But what does it mean to extract payment from someone for a crime that they have committed? And at the end of the day, let's just say, as Sonia Shaw does in our movie, that you get what you want. You know, maybe you get the death sentence, that's what you wanted, but you go home and you're still angry and you're still alone and nothing has healed. And so from that perspective, it's like, well, what would it take for healing to actually happen? What does that look like? And then you begin exploring all the ways that this boundary between I could never forgive you or I could never align myself with you in any way, it starts shifting and changing depending upon the kind of preparation that is created for things like victim-offender dialogue or whether or not someone is simply diverted out of the justice system because what they've actually done doesn't really merit time in prison that's gonna, or juvenile hall, that will continue on for a whole host and variety of reasons. And so I think what fascinates me is really trying to understand, well, what does somebody need when they have been harmed or someone in their family has been harmed? You know, so who was harmed? What do they need? And how does that actually get fulfilled? And oftentimes it's about questions like, were you staking out my house? Why did you pick me? All the way to, what were my daughter's last words? There are things that people want to know about what happened at the crime scene, in quotes, that are not fulfilled by our current justice system. Nor is there any way for us to look at people who are committing crimes who, you know, years earlier when they were younger, they would have been the victims. And so there are these patterns of violence that get reproduced again and again and again, and we're not really changing that. And that's more of a root cause of why, you know, things happen that are untenable.
And isn't the other piece of that isn't just, I want my pound of flesh. It's, I want to make sure this never happens to someone else's daughter. I want to make sure this never happens again. And how restorative justice is a more likely path to keep another crime, the same person from committing a similar crime.
Yes. So absolutely the process of, which is, by the way, what we're covering in virtual reality, is how do you prepare someone for a victim-offender dialogue? Mm. The process is twofold. One, it's being accountable for what you've done, right? And admitting that and taking responsibility for what you've done, while at the same time, what propelled you to commit the crime is actually addressed. So that once you recognize why you've done what you've done is really not something that you want to do anymore. You don't want to live your life that way because you recognize the damage, not only to the people who are your crime victims, but to yourself.
So what does virtual reality do for you on that front that film doesn't? Or let me say, I know you're new to it. What are you hoping virtual reality does?
Well, you know, there's a lot of study on virtual reality. So, I mean, if you're asking me what I hope our particular piece does, that's one question. And so I'll address that one. I think that John Powell, who's someone who I admire tremendously, has had a couple of conferences called Othering and Belonging. And basically what he talks about is that the problems of the 21st century can be categorized or organized under these two, shall we call them, baskets of either there's othering going on, which is at the heart of any conflict, no matter what that might be. And there's also building belonging where people feel like, and this, by the way, is not just you like me or you see me. It's that I have a right to participate in government. I have a right to have my voice be heard. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done to really examine those two categories, and certainly criminal justice is one of them. So what I'm hoping for is that when people put on this headset and they find themselves face to face with someone who has committed a crime, and they are in the process of learning how to facilitate this preparation. That's the character role. When you put on a headset, you become a character in the scene.
And you become the facilitator?
Well, in this case, this is a facilitator in training because uh-huh. this is a very difficult topic that we're talking about. And the person who's putting on the headset doesn't have the skills to navigate that conversation of preparing someone to engage in victim-offender dialogue. But they're right up close to a person who they would categorize normally as other, and having to listen to not only the way that that person wants to be accountable for what they've done, but what the trauma has been in their lives as well. And I think that when you start looking at systems and the structures that support those systems, you're really looking at patterns and relationships. And so I believe that this VR world can do a lot of harm, but it can also do tremendous good, that we can really actually come front to front with someone who we might never meet in our lives, but actually understand who they are, the full I won't say the full, but at least a larger perspective about who they are as a person caught up in a system that is actually perpetuating injustice all the time.
It's so interesting for me to think about it as a medium. I mean, one thing that's been very characteristic of your films is that they're very intentional about the viewing experience being a collective one. Mm-hmm. You know, when you launch them, you have big dialogues in the theater afterwards. When you distribute them, there are curriculum that accompany them online for facilitating discussion groups. Mm-hmm. And virtual reality seems like an incredibly individualistic, isolated experience. I mean, you're literally covering your eyes and ears and cutting yourself off from the people around you for the time that you're immersed in that world.
Yes, but you're also entering a world that uh-huh. normally you would never get into. I'm going to give you two examples of virtual reality that I really think are sort of the model. One is there's a piece, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it offhand, but in Los Angeles, there's a virtual reality piece that is extremely popular right now, and it's on border immigration and border rights. And when you put on that headset, first of all, when you walk into the space, you have to take off your shoes. So you actually are feeling what it might be to be on the ground. It's set up in a way that you're actually having that sensory experience. And then you have to go through the process of what it means to try to get across a border and what you're dealing with. That's one example. So certainly you can see from that example, this is very different than me watching a film about an immigration experience. It doesn't mean that those films aren't valuable, but when I can either add or have for the first time a real experience of someone as a human being who's trying to, not just a criminal or a murderer or whatever, who's trying to make a better life for themselves or their family, that's very different because now I have a different understanding of what might be going on for that person. So that's one example. Another example was done by a woman who worked at the Stanford Labs who did a piece on Hurricane Katrina. Now, her piece was a little bit different because she had a lot of visuals from two-dimensional film and photographs. But what happened was that at some point in the process, you find yourself on a roof, the waters are rising, and nobody's coming. So this embodied experience of definitely, these are both examples of severe trauma that can get passed on generation to generation. When you have that experience, you feel it in a way that can connect with your intellectual understanding of it, a way that hopefully will drive you to not only be more receptive to supporting people in that position, but to be moved into action in all kinds of ways. And I think we're at a point in our lived experiences where we have become numb, jaded to, you know, what people, how people are walking through the world. And that just cannot be.
Isn't there the risk that one of the reasons why studies have shown that we're feeling less empathy towards others is the separation of accountability with interacting directly with others, that we're learning about experiences, learning about events through computers. Mm-hmm. And we can turn off the computer and we can step away, and then we don't have to have any accountability with the person who we've learned about their experience with, and our ability to feel empathy is falling proportionally to that experience. And my one experience with virtual reality, which I had told you about, I covered the war in Afghanistan, and I had a VR experience with being in a battle scene in Afghanistan, and it felt so profoundly isolating to me, that experience, because I stepped away from it, and then I was just left alone with those profound feelings, whereas when I was there, I was around people. And the description that you've just described about being in Hurricane Katrina and feeling that immense, powerful loss and suffering and isolation, and then you're experiencing an isolation as opposed to perhaps in a discussion with someone who went through that experience. And mm-hmm. can you talk about the power and loss there?
Yes. Well, I think that your example is actually a perfect example about how virtual reality should not take place.
Yeah.
And this is why when we set up the virtual reality, we have two different virtual reality things happen. So I'm saying that so I kind of remember to talk about the other one. But in this one where you're putting on the headset and you are talking to this person who is in prison, immediately after, there's conversation. And so I believe that we have to use all the modalities that we possibly can that are going to inspire transformative learning. And what is that? Transformative learning means we get at the embedded assumptions that we have about how we think the world works. And that when you have an experience that is transformative, it's like somebody pulls the rug out from under your feet, which is what you described happening to you, looking at your Afghanistan VR piece. Where was the community to support you after that? Mm-hmm. Where did people come together? It didn't happen. So we are making sure that that happens.
Shakti Butler is our guest. She's president and founder of World Trust Educational Services. And her new endeavor is happening at the Oakland Museum of California this Saturday, June 16th, starting at 2:30 p.m. It's called Beyond Imagining, a virtual experience of justice and healing, where people who show up and get tickets will be able to put on the virtual reality headsets.
And lots of other things, too.
And so I take it you'll be able to do the virtual reality and then plug into the conversation afterwards.
Yes, the whole thing is set up like a fair.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of different stations that you can visit over the course of the time that you're there. There are actually two virtual reality pieces, one that we created in conjunction with VR Sale out of LA, which comes directly, the script comes directly out of our film, Healing Justice. The other one is sort of a semi-virtual reality thing because it's a company called Mersion, and what they do is you create these different scenarios, and when you don't need a headset and it's on a regular like TV screen, but you are practicing skills. So for example, I did one myself around microaggressions. just let me say microaggressions are part of a larger system. You don't just deal with those by themselves. But, you know, there was a scenario. I'm an African-American professor on tenure track. I have a boss who is committing microaggressions on me all the time. I complain to his boss, who's also his friend. And so the scenario is I'm talking to his boss, but behind this avatar, which is not like the VR we're doing where we have actors, but behind this avatar is a live actor. And that live actor is responding to me like a person would in time. So I get to practice my skills of how do I talk to this person with the odds stacked against me to try to convince them that we need more training in this department to look at these issues. While I'm doing that, I'm being taped. So I get to see how I do in talking to someone. So this is a wonderful thing. Let's say I'm learning to be a teacher. I'm going to, and by the way, you know, we know you can get through educational training with never talking about race. So we're not even going to go there. But let's say I'm someone who's studying to work with kids who are, quote unquote, urban kids. For those of you who can't see me, I just made a big face. So anyway, I'm talking to these kids, and what happens is a lot of people are untrained and don't know what they're talking about when they're dealing with kids who are not like them. They hurt these children. They traumatize these children. They punish these children. These children get suspended. And so what a great way for me to be able to practice building skills and understanding what I'm doing without actually, you know, re-traumatizing the very children who I'm supposed to be serving. So that will also be happening there. It's a different scenario. It'll be on immigration. We have someone who's coming up from Los Angeles. Her name is Kamal Sinclair. She works for Sundance, and she wrote an amazing report about the importance of people of color creating narratives in virtual reality, because if we don't do that, then we just keep reinventing the status quo. So we need narratives from people of color in film, in art, in virtual reality, every place where there is a message that needs to be understood in a much deeper way than who's right and who's wrong. There's more too, but I won't go into all of that. There's lots of fun stuff happening also.
Well, Shakti Butler, we're going to plug you into the community dialogue in just a minute.
Okay.
So stick around, folks. We want to open the discussion to you, particularly to your stories. If you have a story about a school that your kids have been through, how that might have been funneling them towards the criminal justice system, we'd like to hear that. If you yourself have been prosecuted, incarcerated, would like to hear how that's impacted you. If you have tried to make amends with someone you have wronged or someone who has wronged you, what that looked like, give us a call, 510-848-4425. That's 510-848-4425. And we'll get into your calls when we're back with Shakti Butler right after the news.
I'm Max Brungle with these headlines. President Trump and Kim Jong-un committed Tuesday to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula during the first meeting in history between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader. Trump agreed to halt U.S. military exercises with treaty ally South Korea. Trump and Kim came together for a summit in Singapore that seemed unthinkable months ago when the two nations traded nuclear threats and insults. The gathering was an attempt to start a process of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. The details of how and when the North would denuclearize are apparently yet to be determined. The government of Spain's Valencia region says it is expecting ships carrying more than 600 African migrants who were rejected by Italy and Malta to call in 3 or 4 days at its port. The vice president of the regional government, Monica Oltra, was speaking to reporters on Tuesday after Spain offered to take in a group of migrants, which includes 120 minors and 7 pregnant women. The migrants were on board the Aquarius. It's a rescue vessel operated by aid group SOS Mediterranean, which has been stuck in the Mediterranean Sea since Saturday. Oltra says the timing will depend on when they depart, the weather, and conditions at sea. She said the Red Cross was preparing to provide shelter and medical assistance to the migrants on arrival, and that other Spanish regions and cities had offered to provide longer-term support. The most closely watched race in Nevada's primary election today is the battle for governor. Clark County Commission colleagues Steve Sisolak and Christina Giunchiolani are vying to be Nevada's first Democratic governor in two decades. Meanwhile, President Trump figures to be a factor in Republican elections in South Carolina, another one of five states holding primaries today. Republican Governor Henry McMaster has the president's backing but faces challenges from four other candidates. McMaster endorsed Trump in the state's early presidential primary in 2016. Primary elections are also scheduled today in Maine, North Dakota, and Virginia. And for the second straight year, throngs of Bay Area basketball fans will get to celebrate the Golden State Warriors with a parade for a team some are calling an NBA dynasty. Hundreds of thousands of fans are expected to line downtown Oakland streets today to cheer the Warriors winning their third NBA title in 4 years. Oakland officials are recommending fans use public transit. Warm and sunny today in the San Francisco Bay Area. Highs in the low 90s, while inland overnight lows in the 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and hot with highs around 100. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 10 on KPFA.
It is now just about 8:35 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, and our guest for the hour is Shakti Butler, president and founder of World Trust Educational Services. She has directed many films about race and gender and privilege in America, and most recently, about trauma and punishment and the criminal justice system and alternatives to it. But her newest endeavor is working in the realm of virtual reality. She's staging an event this Saturday at the Oakland Museum of California, starting at 2:30 p.m., called Beyond Imagining, a Virtual Experience of Justice and Healing. And in just a few minutes, we'd like to take your calls about your own experiences with crime and punishment, with reconciliation. 510-848-4425. Shakti, before we go to our first caller, I do want to pick up on a thread from the conversation just before the hour. You talked about virtual reality as a medium for training people. And the example you gave was someone training to be a faculty member of color dealing with a boss who is a jerk and trying to thwart them. But it seems like the other potential there is to take somebody like me and put me in the body of a faculty member of color and see the world through her eyes, through the medium of virtual
reality. That's been done too. Yeah. So these are two different, I want to make a distinction. What we were talking about is a different form of virtual reality that is specifically for training purposes.
Gotcha.
You can create whatever you want in terms of what are the skills that someone needs to demonstrate to be able to deal with a classroom, let's say, of young children of color who they don't have any cultural relationship with, really. A lot of misunderstanding can happen there, just as an example. That's not the, we're going to have that at the I'm going to call it a fair, but we're also going to have this victim offender dialogue experience. So ask me again, because the question kind of came in.
So there's the training and then there's the empathy, right?
Yes.
I was blown away. I was at the virtual reality lab you described at Stanford. One of the scenarios they were able to load is one where they put you into body that you would not normally identify as your own.
Yes.
And I look into the mirror and there's a black woman looking back. And when I raise my hand, she raises her hand. And inside of like 45 seconds, I'm thinking of her body as mine.
Yes.
And then it leads you through scenarios where you suffer microaggressions and people who look more like me yelling at me. That was profound. Like in the space of a couple minutes, it changed the way I related to the world.
Yes. Yes. So you're actually describing a bit of my curiosity and introduction into virtual reality, which led to me wanting to play. This is just one form of education, as far as I'm concerned, a powerful one. Because I met a woman, I did some work for a major company, and she had created a VR piece of a black woman working in this corporation, and you become this woman, and you have the experiences she has. And she was able to show it to the upper echelon of the organization, which is a national, international organization. And they did a lot of measuring of heart patterning and brain waves. And what they found among mostly white men who were in leadership positions, that within 5 minutes, they had a 60% increase in empathy. So when you think about that, in 5 minutes, to be able to identify in a way that you have never identified with somebody else's experience, now as your own experience, the curtain has been pulled back. You may be receptive to or interested in information that you've never really listened to well before, because you've always had your defense about why that person is just making their own problem or whatever it might be. So the potential is huge. It's really huge.
Well, let's go into some of our listener calls.
Okay.
First on the line, we have Susan calling in from Richmond. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. I wanted to present a scenario at a school that I've been working at, and because of the very complicated situation, I've decided not to go back, but I might be able to make some comments to some of the teachers and the principal. It's a school in Richmond that I kind of describe as white flight comes back to haunt the barrio or the hood. There are some pretty dominant white teachers and a few quiet, almost passive other teachers, Latinos, African Americans. The principal is also kind of passive, and the white teachers that have been there a long time kind of run the school, and he kind of relies on them. And I feel it's because they're very dominant. They teach the lower grades, but then when the kids that they've kind of domineered end up in the upper grades, they end up acting out. And the other teachers might passively go along, and they let these teachers come up and control. But I believe that these lower grade teachers don't really know how what they're doing is affecting the upper grade kids. They used to suspend them, and they complain that they're no longer suspending them. And they've done some of the training of the restorative justice. But I really feel that these white teachers don't really see what they're doing. What you were talking about, the virtual, sounds very interesting, but my question is how best for these white teachers to see their focus and how focusing on discipline has long-term effects, especially because sometimes these teachers don't even realize what it's like to be a child. They sometimes shout at these first grade, I'm talking about little kids, that they will shout at.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have dilemmas in their class because there are special ed issues that the district doesn't want to deal with special ed, so we end up with kids in the class that should really have better learning environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of about 5,000 questions there.
First of all, what you're describing, I think, is all too common, and that it migrates from location to location. At some point, we've been called in, as many organizations have, to do training with teachers. And the efficacy of that training is limited by the powers that be in the district who are paying the money for that training to happen. So now we're talking about, what does it mean to create movement? What does it mean to create political action? What kind of organizing, and I use that with quotation marks around it, but how do we have the people who you're describing as passive and the parents who are dealing with their lives in the way that they're dealing with their lives come together and make demands about what their children are entitled to? That is a very complex process, and there are people who have to come together to lead that process in happening. So what typically happens is what has happened to you. You've decided to leave because you have to live your life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but now that you're stepping out from that, what kind of process can you engage in and maybe link up with other people who are engaging in a similar kind of process to understand how and where change has happened? And can you bring that into the school district, whether it's through pressure in the media, whether it's through organizing parents? I mean, this is a whole other topic. But I do think that virtual reality as a technique, as a tool, if it were used, if this is what we're exploring, can we create scenarios that will actually touch people who are not only creating tremendous harm, but are also scared to death of the very population that they're supposed to be serving. And so this exploration is really, really needed, because just talking to them, it takes too long. It just takes way too long for them to understand the system of inequity and how it functions and the structures that support it.
Chuck, let me jump on that.
Because what about a virtual reality from the point of view of a child?
I think that would be fantastic.
That's what I find that they're lacking.
That would be fantastic. I think that, you know, you're onto something in terms of the range of how virtual reality could be used in a powerful, positive way that really needs to be joined at the hip with social justice efforts.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
So what Susan's describing is also, this is a white people problem. It shouldn't have to be her problem to solve.
I don't think I said that, though, by the way.
What? No,
that
I'm
it's
saying.
Her problem to solve.
No, you didn't. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. I guess the question I'm left with is, how do you get through to those teachers who are damaging, those white teachers who are damaging their students' lives? Because I'm imagining this scenario, Susan's left because she found the circumstances intolerable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I'm one of those teachers, and, you know, I've been that person before, like, we have to own that, I'm probably thinking something like, oh, she couldn't hack it, she washed out, and not accepting any responsibility.
Well, they're probably happy she left because she has a mouth,
mm-hmm.
and she's talking and complaining. I mean, this is a much broader question that falls under the umbrella of how does change happen? This question is a different talk show in a way. I do think that it is there's some kind of combination of policy change and actually holding districts responsible in ways that they're not necessarily held responsible, because it's shifted to, we have to pass all these different kinds of tests. And I don't think my kids in my class can really do that anyway. So it becomes very complex. And speaking as an ex-ninth grade, you know, special ed teacher, I understand this, of you have to engage with power in some way to enforce that the district, it usually comes from a lawsuit of some kind, that the district has to be held responsible and accountable for what is happening to children who are failing.
Speaking to Shakti Butler, president and founder of World Trust Educational Services, and taking your calls at 510-848-4425. Next up, we have an anonymous caller in San Francisco. Good morning. Anonymous in San Francisco, are you with us? Okay. Well, sounds like we may have dropped that caller. While we try to sort out who the next caller is, I'll let you know that Shakti's event is this Saturday at the Oakland Museum of California, starting at 2:30 p.m. It's called Beyond Imagining, a Virtual Experience of Justice and Healing. And virtual experience literally means virtual reality. Part of the event will be the opportunity to put on the virtual reality headsets, encounter some scenarios that Shakti Butler and her team have helped to design, and then plug into the ample dialogue opportunities that they produce. Next on the line, we have Deanna in San Francisco. Good morning.
Oh, hey, good morning. I just was blown by what you're saying. I really appreciate it and want to work in this whole field now. I'm a paraeducator in the school systems. What I was thinking more of was that possibly virtual reality has been used against people of color in the police force, because they seem to be acting in the exact opposite direction of what you're speaking of and trying to point us in the direction of. So I'd love to unify and get together with people who are working in the social justice movement. I have no way to understand, caught up in the whole drama of my own life. I have no barometer to tell me which way to go to meet up with folks who are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered if you could does the exhibit help people organize and get together and work on these things on a level in their work? And I've seen also, unfortunately, women of color also not able to work through their trauma, then project it out onto the children. It's very hard, and it's very hard to address that, because being a woman of not obvious color, though I do identify as a woman of color, I'm Latina and European, the place that I find myself is just trying to be somewhat of an example, and that even becomes a threat to show them. Restorative justice has seemed to be a theme in my life for quite a long time, And if I'm talking really fast, it's because I'm very excited about what you're talking about.
You're not.
Anyway, that's everything.
Yes. Goodness, that's so juicy. I think one of the things that you may want to do is you may want to look up an organization called RJOY. It's a restorative justice organization that is in Oakland. And what they do is they do training in what it means to hold restorative justice circles, which, contrary to some people's belief, is not just a checkoff list of things that you get to do, but actually you have to engage with young people or whoever it is that you're working with. So step one would be to find some kind of organization, I think, that would help you understand how restorative practices actually work and how they work, why they work. At the same time, when you tap into a network like that, you start seeing, well, what are the other organizations that are doing social justice work that may be of interest to you, and approach it that way. I think, what I can do in a very short period of time.
You're amazing. You are also drawing an all-woman lineup of callers, which is also amazing for us. Next on the line, we have Leslie in Oakland. Good morning, Leslie.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Brian, Shante, Brian, I heart you. I just want to say, first of all, I'm here in Oakland by way of New York. I taught special education, corrections, the whole gamut. I feel that you need to stop first rewarding teachers for coming into the inner city. I've worked with all kinds of children, all shades, all races and cultures. I love children. You shouldn't have to reward a teacher to come there. When you do this, first of all, they don't want to be there, some of them. This translates to the children. They're very intelligent. They understand that you don't want to be there, and they're going to shut down. And when they shut down, people need to understand that some of these teachers will treat these children with the same disdain that they would an adult, with the same biases that they have for an adult that they, you know, don't agree with or, you know, culturally have an issue with or whatever. And these children understand this. We need to stop rewarding that. And there should be an accountability. And the virtual thing, it sounds awesome, but we still need touch and contact. We need to know that the people that are coming in contact with our children understand or want to understand what they're going through. And another thing, we need to stop associating poverty with ignorance. I taught special education, and these children were not ignorant. They were quite intelligent. Mm-hmm. Their situations were hard, but they had nothing to do with their intellect. And if you have that disconnect when you come into a situation, you really need to be paid to do that. It's always going to be a problem. And people need to address the fact that, you know, people that have issues with other races will treat a child as if they were an adult. And these kids will, you know, put up their guard. And there's not going to be any learning at all if that happens.
Leslie, I want to pin down what you're talking about. You're talking about programs like Teach for America that encourage young people from relatively privileged backgrounds to come into troubled school districts? Or are you talking about something else?
And I know in New York, you know, the school districts will solicit other, you know, counties to come in. So it's not necessarily Teach America. I am pretty familiar with that. They just do it in general. Hey, you know, come, you know, we have a position. We'll give you a stipend of $4,000 to come in. You know, that's a problem, because as soon as you know, do your year or your 2 years, and usually new teachers do it, you leave. So you don't even get to bond with these children, and it affects the children overall. And then when they have behavioral issues, you segregate them. You know what I'm saying? You segregate them. And if you do have them in special education and there's an inclusion for them, it's not really inclusion. You don't include them. You keep marking them. And our children have to go to school with the fact that you don't care about me. You don't like me. You're not going to help me. And when they decide to put a wall up, the teacher may oftentimes defend themselves in a way that you would an adult. And
you know, Leslie, I want to say how much I appreciate your passion for children. I share that passion with you.
I love them.
I love them too. And I think that what we're talking about is, how do we make change? How do we actually prepare people who are going to interface with our children, whether they're teachers or social workers or psychologists, how do we prepare them effectively so that they identify more with the children, understand what their needs are, and address those, that they have the proper kind of training that is required to really raise healthy children, to educate them in meaningful ways. I'm just proposing...
Hold them accountable.
Yeah, hold, absolutely.
Wrong.
And that is that the hold root of restorative practices is holding people accountable for what they've done, while the same at the same time understanding where they have come from. And so I think virtual reality is just one tool that can be used to speed up that process, in combined with other tools that, I mean, how do you teach people to love children? If you don't love children and you don't love the children that you're serving, then you know, undoubtedly you're not going to do right by them in the way that you could.
And we're also talking at a moment of historic waves of protests among teachers. The other piece is how we value the teacher in this scenario, and how society says we value you, we support you, we believe you need to have a living wage, and teachers having to, you know, literally go on strike by the thousands to just achieve that level of
and how they're support. Trained, you know, so that you can go through your entire period of obtaining a degree and never engage in meaningful dialogue about race. Mm-hmm. Or gender, or class, or whatever. And then you end up teaching in a population that you don't understand and don't have empathy for, really. Maybe intellectually you do, but not emotionally. And I think we're at a point where we need to really connect the emotion and the intellect. That the heart, if we call it that, to represent that seat of emotion, is serviced by the intellect and not the other way around.
Let's try to squeeze in one more caller in the 2 minutes we have left. Angel is on the line in San Jose. Good morning.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Brian. Hi, Sean. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. I just want to basically comment and say that I agree with Susan, Leslie, everybody that has spoke about the environment sometimes that we go through in schools where we have all this, especially white teachers coming with this savior complex, thinking that they're going to make a difference in this kid's life 1 year or one semester if they stay. But a lot of these teachers, they don't understand where the students are coming from. I mean, a lot of the students are coming from vulnerable backgrounds, and it's hard for them to relate and to actually seek an opportunity to help them just basically... fix or just be there to support them. My experience, I worked in a charter school, and a lot of the kids, they really relate to me because I'm a person of color. I'm young, and I come from an immigrant background where I used to basically live with my family, like 10 of us in one house. So much of my students, they found respect on me, or they found someone that they were able to talk. Opposed to white teachers that they will not understand, like, their situation, or if they were, like, food insecure. So, I mean, to me, I just want to give a big thanks to everybody that has spoke, because sometimes I feel, especially educators of color, we don't get the respect, or we don't actually get the chance to actually serve these kids.
Yes, yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think you kind of hit it in two very specific ways. I hope you come to the event, because not only will we be understanding the trauma that a lot of children experience that leads them onto a pathway that gets them into trouble, but we get to see somebody be accountable for that. And the other scenario is about immigration and what happens between children who are documented and undocumented. And so I think we're really trying to make a connection between virtual reality and social justice, and how those two can be of service to creating a more equitable world of belonging.
Shakti Butler, you bring the best out of our audience and onto our phone lines. Thank you so much for coming in to do it.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you.
Shakti Butler is president and founder of World Trust Educational Services. Her new event is Beyond Imagining, a virtual experience of justice and healing. It's at the Oakland Museum of California this Saturday, starting at 2:30 in the afternoon. And that does it for today's show.
Upfront airs weekdays mornings at 7 a.m. We post information about our topics and our guests online at kpfa.org, where you can also dig through our archives, subscribe to the show as a podcast, and connect to us on social media.
If you want to get in touch, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to Corinne Smith, Kirsten Thomas, Salima Hamarani, Janine Etter, Justin Gold, Mitch Jezerich, and Eileen Alfandari. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
I'm Antonia Yuha.
Stay up and stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming your way at 9 o'clock.